General Menezes, Real 16. Now, the next thing was that in September, June 1975, from then until June 78, you were posted to Command 4 Corps on the Northwest Frontier, from the looks of it. Could you tell us...
Northeast Frontier.
Northeast, sorry. Tell me about this posting.
By circumstance that I had to be rotated as Deputy Chief of the Army Staff, having spent 3 years in Delhi, because in the army circles, they were not supposed to spend more than 3 years in Delhi. So I went as General Officer Commanding 4 Corps, which was in the Northeast. Here I had responsibility both for the Burma and Chinese borders, as also the Bangladeshi border in the Northeast.
Now, tell us a bit about the composition of 4 Corps and the role of headquarters.
The 4 Corps had three divisions. The normal corps from the British pattern had three divisions because it was deemed the span of control of command of a lieutenant general in command of a corps. It should not be more than three divisions because it would be difficult for him to handle more than that, particularly in the vast terrain that we have in the Northeast. So I was responsible for a couple of thousand miles of the international border between that with China and Tibet and with Burma. Of course, I had the additional responsibility now with Bangladesh having been created of a border with Bangladesh. We had the friendship treaty with Bangladesh, and it was assumed that with Bangladesh having been created, we would have no further problems with what was East Pakistan from the defense point of view. But that expectation was to be belied because Mujib or Rahman, the architect of Bangladesh, was assassinated in August 75. So he had scarcely been in power for 3 years, but he was assassinated.
What was his name again, sorry?
Mujib, M-U-J-I-B dash or U-R dash Rahman, R-E-H-M-A-N, capital R-E-H-M-A-N, Mujib Rahman, who was the founder of Bangladesh. He had been, as I mentioned earlier, his party had won the elections in 1971, and he should normally then have been Prime Minister of the combined Pakistan, East and West. But Bhutto would not agree to that. Bhutto said he could not agree to a Bengali non-Urdu speaking person being Prime Minister of Pakistan, because even though the population of Bangladesh or East Pakistan was more than that of West Pakistan. But nevertheless, that was the so-called superiority complex, whether it is a Highlander, Lowlander, or whether it is West Punjabi or East Pakistan, that kind of attitude in human society persists.
So what effects did the assassination of Mujib Rahman have?
Well, that really meant that we could now notionally have a hostile government to us again in what was East Pakistan and was now Bangladesh. We had thought that with the creation of Bangladesh and our friendship treaty, there would be no further problems. But straight away, there were problems. And in notional terms, we had to guard our rear, looking to the front of the Burmese and the Chinese international border. We now had to look to our rear also with Bangladesh, which expectation had not been there before. So it was a kind of angst that we had not contemplated.
And was there much trouble?
Well, it persists to this day, in the sense that a lot of the militants or infiltrators in into Indian territory are harbored, sheltered in Bangladesh. So if you have insurgencies in Bangladesh, Pakistan is still now using the post-Mujib Bangladesh to foster insurgencies in the Indian Northeast. They had abated with Mujib's rise to power, and these camps that the Pakistanis had been using for fostering insurgency in India, Northeast India, had been put down. But now, with the pro-Indian government in Bangladesh, Mujib having been assassinated, there were problems thereafter that these camps have now been reactivated. There is also the question of the Bangladeshis infiltrating into India. One of the reasons that Mrs. Gandhi had gone to the UN in 1971 was the fact that over 11 million East Pakistanis had fled into India on account of Pakistani suppression. Now we had a situation of another 11 million arriving in India. Some of those had gone back, so the corresponding 11 million have now still infiltrated into India on the grounds now not of, shall we say, the persecution by the Pakistanis, but on account of persecution of the Hindus. And then the ones who, the Bangladeshi Muslims, now find themselves less prosperous than the Muslims on the Indian side of the border. So therefore they have started infiltrating into India. And the demographic pattern is now changing in the Indian areas by the infiltration of the Bangladeshi Muslims seeking greener pastures. I mean, I would like to say in all humility that these so-called topographical boundaries in mankind's primordial memory did not exist. There was no such thing as an international border. So people did migrate in the past or move around much more than we gave them credit for. So therefore, partition should not have occurred, because then what is now Bangladesh and what is now Pakistan or West Punjab, they would be part of one unified Indian subcontinent. And you can't prevent people moving around if they want to move around. But what did happen with the creation of Bangladesh, there was the element of Bihari Muslims who had migrated to what was then East Pakistan, and Pakistan now refuses to accept them. Bangladesh does not want them because they are not Bengali speaking. So wants Pakistan to take them back. Pakistan says, well, they were from Bihar and not from West Pakistan. So they're dragging their feet on that issue. I mean, it is a tragedy of mankind, or the tragedy of humanity, that human beings become the flotsam and jetsam of power politics.
Now, anything else from your period in command of Forco? Where were you based? In the northeast section, but where was your...
My headquarters was an old tea-planting town called Tezpur. Tezpur, T-E-Z-P-U-R. Now this... The British had taken over the northeast after a war with Burma. The northeast India had been at one stage conquered by the Burmese. The British in 1826 had evicted the Burmese after the Burmese war of that period. And some British traders had smuggled the tea plant out of China. There were tea plants of what you may say indigenous to India in the hills. But the British didn't like that tea. They liked the tea from China. And so they were able to smuggle the tea plants out of China, plant them in northeast India, where the terrain was favorable and suitable. So Tezpur was a tea plantation town originally. And by circumstance of needing a headquarters after the 62 conflict with China, a core headquarters was established over there at Tezpur. In fact, the first British tea planter who had brought the tea plant to Assam was a gentleman called Bruce. He's buried in Tezpur.
So anything that you remember from this time, any particular incidents or issues you had to contend with?
Well, we had issues with China, because China has never really accepted what was called the McMahon Line. They had, in 1962, come up to the foothills, that was the plains of Assam, but then, for purposes of the ceasefire, they had withdrawn from what was then called the Northeast Frontier Agency back to Tibet, and the Indian Army had then followed up to the McMahon Line. So that dispute still continues, and though the dialogue continues variously, alternative meetings in China and India, but whereas the Chinese have accepted the McMahon Line with Burma, they've not accepted it with India, because they want to quid pro quo with the Northwest, that is in Ladakh. So there were incidents.
What kind of incidents?
Well, I mean, we have a paramilitary force called the Assam Rifles, which is deployed specifically on the so-called McMahon Line. And, for example, a patrol was scuppered by the Chinese and killed. So presumably the Chinese also have difficulty in their map reading. And some do cross the McMahon Line, which is the watershed. But nevertheless, you do have the odd encounter or skirmish. Similarly, with the Burmese, it's not so much the Burmese army, or now the Myanmari army. The problem is really, you have this Naga movement, started originally by the gentleman called Fizo, whom I have mentioned.
You mentioned, yes.
Now, this Naga movement wants a pan-Naga, shall we say, country. Problem is that there are as many Nagas in Burma or Myanmar as there are in India. They may have different tribal names. So you had what was called this National Socialist Council of Nagaland, which was trying to create a country that embraced all the Naga areas. So the problem is not only with Burma, as far as these Nagas are concerned, but also with the government of India, because tribes in their primordial movements did move around even to areas which are not part of Assam or Nagaland today. For example, the old Indian state of Manipur. So now the National Socialist Council of Nagaland has split. These people have not been, even though they had a concept for a new entity to have a kind of international Nagaland, but they split on a tribal basis because the Indian Nagas did not want the Burmese Nagas to have the leadership. So you now have this National Socialist Council of Nagaland split between the groups led by the Burmese Naga called Khaplang and the Indian Nagas led by Isaac Swoo. So you have a situation that is dissension amongst the Nagas themselves. But for the purposes of the ceasefires, we've got to negotiate with both of these people. Even though they may not be totally acceptable to us, because there are always so-called peace activists. In the particular case of the Nagas, a lot of them are being fostered in Amsterdam, previously in Britain, but on account of the Government of India protests over here. I mean, Fizzo, of course, did die here, but even at that stage, so with the Reverend Trevor Huddleston and the Reverend Scott having died, though there are pro-Naga movements amongst the British over here, but these people themselves seek shelter in Amsterdam, where there seems to be quite a gathering of Kashmiri militants, Naga militants, for some reason.
Now, anything else you remember about this time?
Well, it was very strenuous, as I say. It was a very vast area, at 1,200 miles of border, which had to be protected and secured. Apart from that, having to face to the rear also now, with Bangladesh having come up, and these infiltrators, I mean, militants in Assam who want independence, various parties with names like the ULFA, that is the Liberation Front of Assam, and so, or other tribal groups like the Bodos. So you are kept on one's toes all the time, whether for ambushes or for infiltration.
So what's the next thing you want to talk about?
After 3 years there, I was then posted as Vice Chief of the Army Staff, and I became number two in the Army. I had already given you this earlier.
Yes.
So this shows Manekshaw on top, but he's not on the active list, as I say, but merely out of deference, he is still shown on the army list because he's alive. It's a kind of special list. We only have one general in the army because we're not allowed by government to have more, on account of the wherever you have more than one general, they have found in Asia that the lobbying starts, whether Pakistan or Thailand, or even for that matter in Bangladesh. Bangladesh has had military coup after military coup, about 21 ever since it had been created. So anyway, so you only have one Chief of the Army Staff, a general, and I was the next in the Army as Vice Chief of the Army Staff.
Then that was June 78 to August 80.
Yes.
At Army Headquarters, New Delhi.
Yes.
Now, what was the nature of your role then?
Now, as Vice Chief of the Army Staff, as I say, I had to officiate for the Chief whenever he was abroad or on leave, as also I had to look after a certain number of directorates in Director of Military Operations, Directorate of Military Operations, Directorate of Military Intelligence, Directorate of Military Training being the foremost. So, as a result, all the military training establishments in India were under my control, as also the military attachés abroad.
Now, what did you do during this period? What were the main themes that you concentrated on?
Well, the main themes were, again, operational, to update our operational posture whenever the Prime Minister or the Defence Minister wanted a briefing. They would come to our operations room and I would brief them on the threats that we were being confronted with. For example, threats from Pakistan or other nations, or what our relationship military should be. For example, when the defense minister went to Afghanistan, I, as deputy chief, had accompanied him, and I still handled Afghanistan now as vice chief. When the defense minister went abroad for procurement, I, as vice chief, accompanied him. So, again, as I say, I had the responsibilities, both military operations, military intelligence, and military training. We have a large number of training establishments and a large number of foreign students who attend. So, as a result, one is again busy visiting these training establishments, because I have to endorse their confidential reports of the commandants concerned. Our training establishments are amongst the most professional in the world, and because we have to train in various terrains, so to that extent, no other, shall we say, staff college would have to deal with so many different types of terrain or our training establishments. What we had was a College of Combat, which has become a war college now. Again, I mean, we outdo any other country insofar as the variety of terrain that we have.
Now, before, you'd identified a problem in changing your sort of, in training your middle rank officers. You know, had anything been done to resolve that? You know, that your brigadiers, your divisional generals, there'd been a bit of a problem you identified. Was anything done about that?
Well, we had set up, as I said, we first had an infantry school which had a senior commander's course at the level of lieutenant colonel. Thereafter, we have now developed what was called a College of Combat, so as also a National Defense College. So you have full colonels now attending courses at what's called the War College, and you have brigadiers attending courses at the National Defense College.
And did that address the problem? Did it work?
Well, it works to the extent, as I say, that we have an army of 1,100,000. We have a shortage of officers, which I think could be overcome if we put our minds to it. But nevertheless, the professionalism of the Indian Army is possibly the highest in the world, or amongst the highest in the world.
Now, any other major issues you were dealing with?
Well, we had these periodic cases of espionage where Pakistan would appear to have suborned personnel on the Indian side. So one had to be alert to that, because after all, every nation has its espionage cases, and India has its share, both on account of its population and the size of its armed forces. It is a difficult task to be on the ball all the time, but nevertheless we have to be in terms of the situation that we're confronted with Pakistan and China. One can only hope that over a period of time the situation will thaw out. It seems to have been thawing out a bit with China, and hopefully eventually with Pakistan. For example, when a coup was attempted in Mauritius, we were able to send a field company to support the government over there. When a coup was attempted in the Maldives, we were able to fly in troops. Earlier, when a coup had been attempted in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, we had been able to fly in troops.
So, what next then? Anything else?
No, then...
You were in this position for about 2 years, were you?
Yes, but that is on account of age. I was superannuated because I was superannuated at the age of... Is that off or on?
It's on.
I was superannuated at the age of 58, which was the then retiring age for lieutenant generals, it is now 60. But that had not come through. At that stage, it came through many years later. But then the government approved my appointment as the managing director of a company in Calcutta with a factory in Jamshedpur called the Tin Plate Company of India Limited.
Now, hang on, before we go to that, how did you feel about leaving the army after all this time? I mean, you know, it had been your life, hadn't it? You hadn't intended it to be, but it had been.
Well, I was reconciled to it in the sense that in terms of the situation, when I opted to stay in the army, I was not aware at that particular point of time as to what the age of retirement was. I mean, it's only after I'd accepted a regular commission that I found that the British retired people as majors at the age of 45. Because they wanted a young army. So consequently, after having taken the decision to stay in the army and not go to the civil services, one then was confronted with a situation that the sword of Damocles in a different form was hanging over your head as to retirement. So I survived being retired at the age of 45 as a major if I was not promoted to lieutenant colonel. And progressively the retirement age that the British had left in India for the army at 55 was, shall we say, extended to 58. The British had fixed the retiring age in India at 55, though to 65 here in Britain, because it was argued that the people who retired at 55 would then be able to enjoy 10 years of a retired life in Britain. Whereas if they retired them at 65, they would have died either before they retired or they would have died shortly after arriving back here. But with longevity increasing, the government of India eventually had relaxed it to 58 under pressure. And of course, now, as I say, it is 60.
How did you feel about going then? I mean, did you accept it or were you a bit resentful?
No, I was not resentful in any way. I was reconciled to it because in the sense that I had become number two in the army. If my immediate superior at that point of time, General O.P. Malhotra, had been, shall we say, a bit older, I could have succeeded him. But that did not make me resentful in any way, because I was not in any way ambitious enough to succeed in a dead man's shoes or anything like of that nature.